That's right. Welcome to the couch live here on WPSN99.com. You're probably watching it on Facebook Live. That's facebook.com/WPSN99. Or you're watching it on YouTube or you're listening to it as a podcast. I do not know. Either way, I am the street certified dope doctor Louis Delgado here with you, certified addictions professional, and been doing this show for what, 21 years? Longest running show on addiction recovery on the planet. Here with my partner, the Dharma guy, Trinity Phillips. What's up, Trinity?
Yeah, hey, what's up, man? Still good, huh? Dealing with this heat. Yeah. You can barely hear me. I don't know. I can talk louder. I don't know why. Yeah. We're having audio issues today, apparently. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, apparently there's audio issues. I guess when we hear the show back, we'll know how bad or how real it is.
Yeah.
Because apparently you can't tell on your end.
Nope.
But anyway, regardless, we're still going to talk about chronic relapse today, Trinity. We're still going to do it. So let's bring on our guest. We have a guest today. Her name is Angela Moore from Armor Up. And Angela was supposed to be on our show, I don't know, a little while back. And then something happened, Trinity. What was it? I double booked myself or something.
I don't know. This is the first I'm hearing about it.
I was driving one way. She was driving another. I had to leave for some reason. I don't even remember why.
Nice.
There she is. There you go. Marissa on Facebook Live is making fun of you complaining about the heat. You get no love about it.
No, I don't, but that's okay.
Anyway, welcome, Angela. How you doing?
I'm great. Thank you.
Well, so look, this way you didn't have to actually come out to New Smyrna Beach, so saved you the trip.
Darn. I'd rather be there.
I don't know. It looks like you're in a pretty nice place where you're at.
Right? I like the backdrop. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you're on your screen porch. It's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful Friday. Some people are freezing where they're at. You look pretty comfortable. I'm pretty comfortable. Trinity, of course, he's always hot, so it doesn't matter.
I'm always hot. But I do like the dog in the background. That's awesome, man. What kind of dog is it?
He's a mix. He's a rescue.
Right on. Very cool.
Aren't we all?
Yeah.
We're all rescues. Yeah.
He's good.
All right, so let's get into it. Angela, so I mentioned that you're with Armor Up. So before getting into your story, before talking about chronic relapse, can you just let us know a little bit about Armor Up? Like, what is Armor Up?
Armor Up is a nonprofit that I started. It's a recovery homes and ministry.
Okay.
And I have two recovery homes, Freedom House and Victory House in Longwood. And my mission is to help other women out of the pits of hell, the chains of addiction. And that's what Armor Up does. We do outreaches and missions and all kinds of different things. But the main goal is to help women that are struggling in addictions or human trafficking or whatever to help them heal from the inside out.
All right. We'll get a little bit more into what Armor Up is for everybody. Tune in. Stay tuned in. Or if you're watching this on video, zoom all the way to the end and you'll probably get the details of how to reach out to them. Should you require their services or want to know more about Armor Up. But for now, Angela, we're talking about chronic relapse today because you define yourself as a chronic relapser, right? So what is a chronic relapser?
A chronic relapser is someone that was in her first treatment center at 13 years old, 7 DUIs later, 45 years, we got 7-8 years clean at one point, in and out of recovery. And I just didn't know how to stay clean. I did not know how to stay clean.
Mm. 7 DUIs. Do you have a license right now?
I do. That is,
right on.
Well, that's a whole nother program. That's miracle.
Yeah, you would think that after 7 DUIs, Angela, you would just like not even be allowed to get a driver's license.
Start taking the bus.
I know, right? That's a whole nother story. Yeah.
Yeah. So 13 years old. So what's happening at Angela at 13 years old that you end up in a treatment program at 13 years old?
Well, I started using at 9, started smoking pot.
Me too.
And really? 9?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, I wonder what age.
You sure we didn't know each other?
I don't know.
It was hard for me to find another 9-year-old to party with. So
I know. Well, You know, actually, my little girlfriend, who a lot of her mom was a dealer, so we got to steal a lot of pot from her mom, yeah, was 8. It's 1 year younger. Yeah, a lot of my friends were.
Yeah, my best friend at the time was 1 year younger, so unfortunately, he started at 8 because I was 9.
Yeah, just so we know for the record, man, I have my youngest right now is 9, and I can't even fathom the idea that he would be using substances right now. Like, he's so stuck into Fortnite and stuff.
Yeah. Trinity, especially when I look like 5 at 9.
That's crazy to me. Like, I didn't know what I was doing at 9, but I don't think usage was on my mind at that point.
Yeah, it wasn't good. I know. Angela, tell us though. You know, we always talk about me, so tell us about you. So you're 9 years old. What's going on at 9?
So I'm 9. I just, you know, I come from a family of addiction. You know, it's a disease. Everyone I knew smoked pot, smoked dope, and it was the thing, and I wasn't ever going to do it. I didn't want to be like my dad right up until the day someone said, here, you want to hit? Yeah, sure. And there I was, very compulsive from the, you know, I was smoking cigarettes at 6 years old, skipping school. So, you know, I already had the isms. So when I started, you know, smoking pot, you know, it was like the medicine my body had always been missing. I mean, from the first hit, I was hooked. I was smoking morning, night, fourth grade, out of the vents in the bathroom in school. And I had, you know, my aunt, all of her friends were older. A lot of the people I ran with were older, although one of my best friends was 8. But so I could get it anywhere. I could get it from my dad. I could get it anywhere. So
it sounds like your surroundings were full with it. See, that was different than mine. See, I didn't have the surroundings like that. I actually ended up in the surroundings, which is why I started using. But you actually had it within your home, the place that we normally would want to call our safe area, right? This is where you're supposed to be completely safe, and it's supposed to be structured, and it's supposed to be warm and loving, and all the bad stuff of the world is supposed to be out of it. But I guess you're saying that your initial start wasn't quite like that.
Well, I lived with my mom, and you know, we had, you know, issues there, but there was no pot there. But I went with dad on the weekends. And my aunt, who was 6 years older, babysat me a lot. So that's where I learned to do it a lot. Then my dad's, I had free access and rein to anything and more. I mean, we did bigger, better things by the time I was 13, me and my dad. Mm. He was my biggest ally at the time. So.
Yeah. So you're 13 years old. What are you using at 13 years old that puts you in a treatment center?
Well, I was using every drug there was, but you know, at 13, I remember, you know, a real big moment for me was when I remember one night my dad said, open your mouth and shut your eyes and daddy will give you a big surprise. And that was my first 2 714 quaaludes. So I was using everything and anything at that point I could get my hands on. Like I said, my friends were older. So I was using everything, anything. And by 13, 14, from the first beer I ever had, I was a blackout drunk. One was too many, a million, not enough. I would drink till blackout. And I never puked, unfortunately. So I could just drink.
Right.
But I always ended up with blackout.
And what about knowing that, knowing the difference between right and wrong at that age for you? Did you even know that what you were doing was supposed to be kept secret and probably shouldn't tell anybody? Or did you not have those boundaries at that age?
I did have those boundaries. My mom, it was my little secret. I was very much a perfectionist, a people pleaser. I acted perfect, made good grades at school. Oh, yeah. No, mom didn't know. But then when I started running away a lot because I would get grounded because I wouldn't, you know, that's a whole nother story. At like 14 and a half, I did get sent away to homes, to a group home. I got put in detention because I just kept running away. I wanted to use. No one was going to stop me. So I did eventually get caught, got put in some homes for a couple of years. I was out played the game, talked the talk, month out. I was using again, ran away to Texas when I was 16, came back almost before 17, ran away to Florida, and here I am. So
where was home initially that you went to Texas? Where was home initially?
Kansas City, Missouri.
Okay. So where Maynard is from. Maynard tends to watch this show from up there in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Maynard, if you're watching, but he's up in Kansas City. So you went from Kansas City, Missouri to what part of Texas?
Austin.
And how did you get to Austin?
I hitchhiked with my boyfriend.
It always sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Hitchhiking with a boyfriend.
Back then, we hitchhiked everywhere.
That was a mode of transportation, actually.
It was. That's how you want to go. So you didn't go stick up your thumb. You didn't, you know.
So to put this in context, what year are we talking about and how old were you?
Wait a minute. That's not a fair question.
Everything is fair game on this show. So if you're going to come on this show, I'm going to ask you questions that you probably don't want to answer.
That's funny. What year was that? Well,
yeah,
born in 66. That was probably like, you know, my time frames even to this day are not the best, kind of foggy, but I guess that would have been about 1982.
Okay. Okay. 70,
you know, 82, 83. I got my GED.
All right. So Ozzy's real hot out there with Diary of a Madman at that time. And so you're hitchhiking across the Midwest part to the West a little bit. Go to Austin. Austin's a happening scene at that time. It's still not what it is today. It's not the way it is today, but it was a pretty happening scene already by that point in time. Had a lot of music going on there. Why did you go to Austin?
I don't know. There was no place better to go. We knew that.
There were people hitchhiking to California at that time. Why'd you go to Austin?
And I was going to hitchhike to California, as a matter of fact, because Led Zeppelin was playing. And a friend of mine on a motorcycle, and we were going to go run away and go to there, but John Bonham died. That's the year John Bonham died, drowned in his soup, so we didn't go.
Yeah.
I ran away with my boyfriend, went to Texas. We just went for like, I don't know, a month. The shrooms were good. You could go pick them right out in the pasture. So we did that for about, you know, a month.
Yeah.
And then came home. I stayed in Kansas City for, you know, maybe 6 months.
Right.
And then I ended up going to Florida. I got 3 DUIs by the time I was almost 17. I had been in some hit and runs, totaled my car. My life was a mess. And I thought if I got away from my dad, I had been hooked on Valiums for a year with my dad doing unspeakable things. Right. And my dad was my best friend. And it was not a good relationship. It was very sick. It was very twisted. I figured if I got away from Kansas City and all the DUIs and all the trouble and all the people, we call that a geographical change. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Addiction.
Yeah.
That I would fix everything here. So I left all my friends, all my family, and came with my dad's best friend down to Florida. We went through Mardi Gras and all that. And we came to Florida. That was one big. And then we came to Florida. And I moved in with my step grandpa. I knew him here, and he couldn't keep his hands off of me. So I ended up moving in with some guy and ended up, of course, wherever we go, there we are, using IV drugs with him, doing worse than I was doing up in Kansas City.
So. Right. You know, here's the sad thing, Angela, as you tell your story, I get like a chill because I can think of countless number of females that I've heard tell their story, and there's so many similarities to the level of abuse by men at that point in time, especially, and the things that a lot of women did in those early years, before recovery was even a word that they even wanted to listen to. And there's so many women that actually still blame themselves to this day for some of those decisions that they made while intoxicated or while running or while escaping or while looking for a better way to feel. So can we fast forward a little bit into your first desire to get clean? Because I want to get to the chronic relapsing part. And I really don't call it a relapse when you quit because someone else made you quit. You really didn't want to quit. But I do call it a relapse when you do want to quit and then you end up using again. Do you remember the first time you wanted to quit?
I do. I was around 21. Might have gone to my first, I don't know, my ex-husband had hit me with a Jeep both my arms and legs. It was a mess. And I think that I was 23. No, I'd already been in around 21. Okay. Was when I was first went into a treatment center, and I did want to get clean because I was good. Bad. Yeah. Oh yeah. But yeah. That didn't last.
And do you remember what it was that you didn't want to give up? I know you wanted to get clean, but you know how we hold on to some reservations, which is typically how we end up in relapse anyway. Like, what was it that you just did not want to hear the people that were educating you and helping you and supporting you? What was it that you just did not want to change?
I didn't know how to have fun. Yeah. I didn't know how to feel my feelings and get through. I wasn't healed. I was a broken little girl in an adult's body. And as much as I wanted it, I had all these false belief systems about myself and strongholds and wounds. And when you don't heal from the inside, you can want to get clean all you want. You can love God all you want. You can want it, but if you don't heal from the inside, you're going to go back. That's it. No matter how bad you want it, your intentions will get you nowhere. It wasn't anything, you know, it wasn't that I wasn't even willing to go to any lengths. I didn't know how. I didn't.
And neither did we at that time, Angela, because if I'm doing the numbers correctly, then we're talking about mid 80s approximately, right? Mm-hmm. You know, getting into the later 80s, recovery looked way different back then. Yes. First of all, everything was in the closet. So you weren't able to speak about so many of the things that traumatized you during your use. There were very little women in recovery at that time anyway, so you were lucky to at least find one mentor that was of the same sex.
Right.
So I'm picturing you at 21 and knowing the landscape that I do at that time. That's not an easy ordeal. It's hard enough now, and we have so much support and so much knowledge and so much ability, and so much understanding of the disease and how to help people. Back then, we knew nothing. So it had to be hard for a 21-year-old Angela that wanted to get clean to even open up about some of the stuff that was troubling you.
I didn't even know to do that. Yeah. I mean, they talked about the 12 steps, but it wasn't like, you know, I just didn't even know to do that. I thought if you go to meetings, you know, that's what they say, meeting makers make it. You know, you go to meetings. I remember that.
Yeah.
And I would go to meetings, but I didn't heal and I didn't change my playmates and my playgrounds. I didn't know how to, you know, I was in a sick marriage, you know, I just, yeah, you're right. A lot of what you say, I didn't know it was an inside job. I didn't know how to go there. I wasn't there yet.
Yeah. So how long does that stint of sobriety last?
Not long. I mean, I was in and out, I would say from 21 until 27, I got a couple more DUIs. I had ran away from three, but then at 27, I had gone in treatment a couple times, had two children. And at 27, I can't remember the DUI. I just remember waking up, seeing my little girl's eyes. I was in a blackout and I just was like, oh my God, what am I doing? I had been like raped the week before by a lot of terrible stuff. I couldn't tell anybody. I was ashamed. It was in a blackout, thought I deserved it. And I went into AA and I actually stayed clean for about a year. I didn't heal from the inside out. I didn't work all the steps. I was kind of like half in. I went to meetings. I had friends. I did. I went and sang karaoke with, you know, Martin. I can't even think of his last name. He has a couple sober living homes now. But so I got clean.
I know who you're talking about. So let me pause you for a second. So you said you had two kids and you lost two kids. And just for the sake of understanding, and there's a lot of women that'll be listening to this and watching this that have also lost kids. So when you say lost, do you mean miscarriage or do you mean DCF?
Honestly, and yeah. I'm saying this on a radio show, so I gotta be honest, I had two abortions.
Okay.
And all I ever wanted to be was a mommy.
Okay.
That's all I ever wanted to be. But I was so messed up and had so much cocaine in me. I was such a mess. I'm not justifying. I'm just saying, yeah. I couldn't have them. I just God knows
what would have happened. Yeah.
God knows what would have happened. I regret it. I'm not for all that now, but still, God knows what he's doing. Thank God. That's what I meant. I probably shouldn't have even said that, but you know, I did. So yeah, but that is what happened.
Yeah.
But then
it's your reality. It's your story. It's your reality. And the reality you share is actually shared by so many others.
Yes.
So I would hope that you know, you and many others can heal from whatever decisions you had to make. And when I say have to make, I'm talking about have to make at that point in time. That's the best thinking that you can come up with at the time to keep navigating through the difficult waters that you're navigating. Let's continue then. So you have two children. Did you say daughters or what did you say?
A daughter and a son.
A daughter and a son. So you had one of each. Now you have the two kids. Is this with a husband, boyfriend, or you also said that you were raped? Is this a child of rape? Like, where did the kids come from?
No, they're both. I ended up with the guy that I met when I was 17 and we were together 23 years and ended up having three kids together.
Oh,
so
right on.
We were in and out, whatever. But yeah, we were together and we had two kids. Even though I left him when I had the second one and had her in Kansas City. But yeah, that's another story too. So yes, we had two kids together.
That's a beautiful part of the story though.
Yeah.
Part of it.
We kept coming back to each other, I guess. I mean, we're not together now. We were sick of track sick. You know, we didn't know how to live without each other. I don't know.
Right.
I don't
know. Right.
We had three beautiful kids out of the deal. So, hey.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So now you're into the 90s. Very different world by the 90s. You know, women's recovery is building up in the 90s. We start having women's groups. You probably found some of those early on. You say you were here. So let me see. If you were here and I was here by then. So I know there were some women groups. You know, I know where they are or where they were at that time. Where did you?
1993 it would have been, because my daughter was almost one. It was Rebo's. Right. Rebo's, which is 5 minutes from my house right now.
Yeah.
Rebo's.
So in 93, I went through Rebo's too. So I probably saw you there. We just don't remember.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. I was at Rebo's. The greenhouse was really huge at that point in time.
Been there.
I'd go by still working on it because I really wanted to do NA, but I kept doing AA because it worked better for me.
Me too.
Yeah. And then, of course, Pass It On was my home group at that point in time, if you know that one. I'm sorry, what?
I've been to all of them. I know there's little reverb. Sorry. Been to all of
them.
Okay. Yes.
That's okay. All right. So now, I have the context of where you're at that time and what you're trying to do at 27. All right, so what happens after 27? Is that your sobriety date? Is that your sobriety age?
No. So I get clean. I do. Okay. I stay clean for almost a year and some things happen, but then I get clean again and I stay clean like seven or eight years. It's kind of foggy when I started dabbling in this and that. Right. I don't know. But I know I was selling timeshare, doing great. I had arrived. I was making up for the wreckage of my past and super mom, super worker, you know, making a ton of money selling timeshare. I had arrived. I was even training people on to think their way into anything they wanted. I was fixed. I was in control. I was doing great. But you know what? I still had this whole big empty hole inside of me because I had never worked the steps of recovery. I had never healed, but I did stay clean for like 7, 8, 9 years. And then I was getting migraines and that opened that door to those painkillers, opiates. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew though. So I started using opiates 7, 8, 9 years in. I had done cocaine a couple times, but that didn't count because it was only a couple times. You know, I drifted away from meetings. I wasn't hanging out with, you know, the people in AA. I didn't go anymore. I was just doing it on my own, right?
Let's time that for a sec because it makes sense. You were successful, and you felt successful, and you know, especially when you start to do well, you don't want to keep going. You want to move on. You know, it's a very normal, natural feeling. to want to not have to go to these meetings anymore and be stuck in your past. You want to be normal, you know, because we all have that obsession to be normal and not have to be always saying, I am this or I am that, and I still need this help or else I'm going to crumble and fall and fail. So it's very normal to want to separate from that.
And, you know, we're very, us alcoholics and addicts, man, we're no wimps. You know, it's not hard being an alcoholic. It's not easy being an alcoholic and addict. And we make it out of that. A lot of us, you know, that stubbornness and determinedness, I mean, it carried me through. And by God, I had arrived and I was going to be cheerleading mom and football mom and super wife and make six figures a year. And I was winning trips all over and making tons of money and running motivational meetings. And yeah, I didn't need all that anymore. I had arrived, I thought. I had that was my idea of success.
Right.
Normal was, I thought.
Right. I thought. Now, at that point in time, Angela, at that point in time, had you done any kind of individual therapy or stuff to kind of dig deeper into maybe some of the things that started this whole train from riding alone?
Well, I had been in and out of counseling. I started seeing my first shrink, my first counselor when I was 9 years old. Sorry about that to the profession.
But, no offense to anyone, I'm sure.
So sorry. But, you know, because I believe in counseling. Of course, EMDR, trauma therapy, it did a lot of good for me. At 9 years old, I had ulcers because I worried so much. At nine, I was the first. My doctor didn't even test for ulcers for like months because I was just a worrier, right? So I had ulcers at 9 years old. And so I forgot what the question was. So
what I was asking, had you done any internal work therapy wise? Post-recovery, so though, I hear that you were in a treatment. I hear that you were in therapy. But in that seven-year stretch, you were doing well. Did you go to therapy during that seven-year stretch?
I think I did a couple times because I had always been labeled manic depressive. I told you things are kind of blurry. So I would be on and off my antidepressants. And I would always try to look. I don't know during that 7 years, actually. I have been to so many counselors and so many types of therapy during that 7 years. No, I probably got too busy. I was busy being a mom and a wife and a worker and saving the world, I thought, you know. I don't think so. I think at first, the first year I was very active in AA, my kids grew up at Rebo's. My kids did grow up at Rebo's. I would still run to meetings, you know, here and there. But they slipped off in the end and it was few and far between. And no, I don't think I was going to counseling during that time. Now before, but no.
And what about your friend? What does your friendship group start looking like? And what does your relationship start looking like 7 years in?
I don't really have friends. I poured myself into my kids and my work and my husband. I was super mom, super wife, super, you know, I had all these people I trained, but personal friends, no, not, I mean, I knew everybody, I liked everybody. They'd probably be offended right now. I guess I did have a few friends here and there, but, and I did in AA when I first got clean, I did, but not like best, I guess I had friends. I didn't hang out with them a lot though, those last like 5 years. I was so into, I mean, we had parties. I had friends, but they weren't the AA friends anymore after the first. I would go there and they would all be my friends, but I would leave and go do my own thing. I always did my own thing. I was always, you know, doing my own thing. I had in control of my own life.
Which is also pretty normal. But so those little moments that you had where you did a little cocaine here, you did a little cocaine here, what we would call a lapse, right? These little lapses.
Yeah.
Did you open up about those lapses to anybody during that time period? Or did you just figure, well, it didn't turn into anything big, so I'm going to keep this a secret?
Yep. I kept it a secret. I did it with my husband. It was just me and him, and, you know. Okay. And then
so it felt
I think,
safe. Yeah, so it felt safe. It felt okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I didn't drink and I didn't end up in a blackout and I didn't end up with, yeah. So, yeah.
All comments that we say to ourselves, all things that we say to ourselves, right? These are normal things. In other words, you know, I want to keep reiterating how normal a lot of this really is for people that suffer this. I mean, this is not unusual, you know, to be thinking this, especially when you start using things that are not of your addictive crash, you know, that they weren't part of your crash down, you know, you think, right. Oh, well, it's a little bit of pot or it's a little bit of alcohol or it's a little bit of, in your case, a little bit of cocaine, but I'm using it with my husband and it's safe. So I get it. All right. So then what happens?
So I get these migraines. I go to I have some female problems and he gives me a prescription of opiates. It was hydrocodone. It was, okay. Yeah, hydrocodone. And that was all it took. Oh my gosh. Okay. That was all it took. And at first it was just, oh yeah. The first one I ever took, I was like, oh my, and I remembered, I remembered everything and I didn't do anything stupid. And I was superwoman. Like they gave me this supernatural
you got energy.
Yeah.
So now we're about 2000, right? Then we're about 2000 when that whole thing started.
Yes. A little before, actually. I got, we actually got married in 99 and I had already like 98. I told you my time frame still to this day. I don't know.
That's around fine. There. Yeah. The end of the 90s. We're now, so now in retrospect, we're looking at the end of the ecstasy days. You know, we had our first opiate scare and crisis around that time period, and we were just coming out of that. And so physicians got involved a little bit more in things, and they started prescribing opiates a little bit more, late 90s, early 2000s. And so we started finding a lot of street pharmaceuticals out there. So, again, in line with where we were at the time. In the late 90s and early 2000s. All right. So then how long does that last before it's, oh shit, this isn't going good?
Yes. Well, I, several years, if not 5 or 6 or 7 years. I mean, nobody even knew. And I was doctor shopping at this point. I could get them anywhere. I mean, I could get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and you didn't need x-rays or anything. And you could pay cash here, use insurance for this script over there, and the computers weren't linked and everything happened. Because I was going to all kinds of, by the end of my opiate use, they had just, all my doctors were getting busted and they had linked the computers. And so I couldn't get, you know, $1,000 a month anymore. But anyways, so the first 5, 6, 7 years, it was like, oh, I'll just do like 10 on Saturday and 10 on Sunday. That's how it starts. And after a year or two, I was a control freak. I could literally hold off all week knowing I was going to get to do, I didn't want to waste just to have 2 a day. So it started, you know, when I was just getting a certain amount to where, oh, I could just do 10 on Saturday and have a really good day and 10 on Sunday. And then it got to the point, at some point it turned into every day. People still didn't know. I mean, they really didn't. My husband didn't know. My kids didn't know. I quit my timeshare because I quit my timeshare. I can't hardly focus on that anymore. And you know, OxyContin and all that had came out by then. OxyContin was a big thing.
Right. So let me pause you there for a second because So here's now what I'm hearing is, so at first I'm able to control it. I'm able to say when and how I use it. It's totally planned out. I am in control. And if I control it this way, if I just use it on the weekends and I just do it the way I want to do it, then I can keep doing this. So you could see, like Trinity, I'm speaking for Trinity and anybody out there that doesn't really get addiction or has never been an addict. You could see how you could easily manipulate yourself. This is where your best thinking is messing with you. This is where your sense of control and need to control looks like it's winning. And here's the thing. All addicts really have this innate desire to really control You know, we just have this desire to not want to be out of control so bad. That's why I always find it funny when a non-addict says, I can never become an addict. And I say, why? And they go, because I hate being out of control. Well, so do addicts. Addicts feel like they're in control, you know?
Yes.
So initially that's the pool. That's what convinces us that we're okay, because initially we tend to show that we can control it. Mm-hmm. So now back to the story, but then it unravels and then things start happening. You lose your job at the timeshare, continue on.
Well, you know, and to add to that, Louis, we believe the lie that we're doing better on the pills. They're making us smarter and think clearer, and we can do more, and we can
getting stuff done. I'm making money.
Yeah.
I'm selling more.
Yeah. You know, they weren't like cocaine where, you know, you do a line and 30 minutes in, you want to do another line. You're not jonesing like that. I mean, you're functional. You're more functional with these even.
Right.
So I wasn't ever able to be functional with alcohol and coke and all the other drugs. This one, wow. Yeah. So I get a OxyContin, which is very hardcore. I was always the kind I was smart. Well, a lot of us are smart, you know. I was very street smart. Yeah. So I knew where to get them. I had a friend who was HIV positive. I could sell them for this much amount, you know, $25 a pill and make this many. And so I'm doing this. I'm still working timeshare, but I'm getting tireder and tireder because I'm not sleeping as well. And it's hard to get up at 6 a.m. now and go sell timeshare. And so I quit and I start my own house business. And that does well. I'm good at rehabbing houses. I'm a real estate agent. I can do it on my own terms. I can go work all night if I want. I can go work all night, sleep half the day, rehabbing a house. And, you know, so that was working for a while. I got my husband involved. Nobody still knows. I quit being friends with that friends. Of course, the drug split us up that I could get all those pills from because she was HIV positive and the OxyContin. And then I get into the oxycodone and the hydrocodone and the doctor shopping and all of that. And that's when I think one day it was to the point where very rarely would I run out. I wasn't the kind to leave myself, you know, like one of my friends, my dad's best friend, I had come to Florida with, we had hooked up and become friends again because he was, you know, a dealer. So whatever. And so I could sell them all to him, make enough to still have, you know, 500 for myself, 500 sold. I could make money. And long story short though, is that I was such a control freak. Like some people, you know, they do everything they have. Like he could never understand. He would do all that he had and then he'd be jonesing for 3 days until he could get to the doctor. I would like plan it out and watch the clock and watch the clock and watch the clock. But those few times, that last time I had run out, I'm jonesing, I'm feeling bad. My son wanted to go on the boat. I told him he could. I'm losing my mind. He told me off. He called me a name. All I know is I lost my cookies. I ended up having like a breakdown. I told my husband, who didn't even know, you know, I was going to the bar down the street and he's like, where are you going? You know, I had been going in and out of meetings, but they didn't know. They knew I was high. I don't know. And that was it. That was the first time I go to treatment. I really want to get clean. But I stayed in my sick relationship and I still didn't heal. I went to treatment down in Tampa for 30 days, told my kids I was doing a woman's retreat. I got out and I had all intentions of staying clean. They had started me on this codependent 12 steps, you know, and I wanted it, but I got out and I was still in this sick, toxic relationship and I didn't know how to heal with him there. I would try to do the right thing, but he never got a program of recovery. He wasn't a blaring addict like me. He had his own demons he was battling, and it was a very sick and abusive relationship mentally. Yeah. Just we weren't well. And so I would quit going to meetings and quit working the steps, and you know, I ended up going back out, and I battled that in and out of treatment and the opiates for 11 years, to make a long story short. He ended up leaving. I kicked him out. I lost everything. He took all the money with him. You know, oh my gosh, left me. And that was okay. We had a huge, I had my little girl, and you know, in and out at that time of treatments, and it 11 years total, and ended up with the opiates. Oh, wow. And then I got my seventh DUI, September 11th, 10 years ago this year. And I wasn't drunk at all. I had a ton of opiates in me, but it was God. I had my little girl in the car and her little best friend. It was midnight. I got in a wreck. Yeah, with them in the car. And at that point, I just wanted to die on opiates. I didn't have a guts to put a bullet in my head, because I had to put a bullet in my head if I would have thought I wouldn't go to hell. Because at that point, I knew my daughter would be better off without me. I believed the lie. Everyone would be better off without me. Really, I did. Yeah. I really was just waiting to die, because I had rotted all my teeth. I was in and out of the hospital with colon cleanses, cancer colon cleanses, because I couldn't go to the bathroom for a month at a time. I was a mess. And I was just waiting to die. Well, I got that seventh, and I wanted to die. You know, that brought me peace. The thought of, I tried to put myself in a car and turn on the ignition, and I backed out of that, you know. And so I got that seventh DUI, and I ended up in jail. And I tell you, I cried from a place like I had never cried before, literally. And I knew God wasn't going to let me die. I knew he was not. I just had this like spiritual, like he wasn't going to let me die. And that, I don't know, I got the gift of desperation and hopelessness. I got the gift of, I'm done. I'm done. I'm done. And before that day, I was not done. I was just waiting to die. I was just watching the clock. Doing what I had to do to take care of my little girl, just me and her, isolated in my little house. Everyone else had left, and I had lost everybody and everything. I had no friends. I had nothing, and except my dude I dealt all the pills with, just to keep my habit. And so that was it. And that was 10 years ago, September 11th, and October 4th. It took me 3 weeks to figure out how to detox from the opiates, because that was not going to be pretty. And so October 4th is really my clean date from alcohol and opiates, my total clean date from all of it, because it's all the same thing. But September 11th brought me to my knees.
So before getting into the detox and the rebuilding of your life afterwards, I want to get back to this living to die, because I think we all, any of us that have went through that can kind of relate to that part of it, especially where there is a sense of an odd piece of no longer caring about the life form that you are, and feeling that the whole world and your loved ones would be better off if you just die. You won't be a burden anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if it's just because, you know, we don't have to feel guilty about it then, or that we don't feel like as much of a failure then, or whatever. Just gives us an excuse to keep using. I don't know. The point is though, it's very relatable. There's a lot of us that have felt that, what you felt. So you, like when you talk about it and when you speak of it, I'm sure everybody goes back into their own personal memory of when they felt that sense of blank, just a no joy about life, no emotion about life. It just is. And by that point in time, Angela, you, like many of us, probably had a lot of people that passed away by that point in time. And so the reality of death is there. I mean, you know, people that have passed away
dad died in his disease.
Right. So by that point, you're thinking, wow, lucky them sometimes, you know, wow. You know, now they don't have to deal with this bullshit that I'm dealing with. You know, so this happens. Now you have this awakening of some sorts. Now, how do you grab on? So this is that moment, like the roulette wheel that everybody also experiences. And even some of you that are still using right now, you have experienced this. So I'm going to, hopefully we are going to help you recognize when it happens and how you got to just grab onto that moment, because we get these little windows of opportunity, right? It's like all of a sudden our number hits. It's like winning the lottery, only you don't know what you won yet. You don't know the amount of money yet, because it, you know, just like you, Angela, I'm sure didn't know how good this was going to feel, you know, 10 years later. I didn't know how good this was going to feel so many years later. We just don't know. We don't know what we're going to enjoy. We don't know what we're going to love. We don't know that life is going to really be okay, because it's impossible to even view that from that standpoint. I mean, at that point, you don't even know what you're going to value in recovery. So the number hits, your number hits, it lands on your number. You have that window of opportunity. Angela, what did you do to grab onto that moment and make it what it is today? What did you do?
I let go and I let God. I surrendered. I just said, I'm done. You know, I always believed in God and loved God, but I was in control. I was going to get myself clean. I was going to be okay. I was going to fight my way out of this. And I realized, I just kept hearing God say, hang on for dear life. Everything you ever needed, everything you ever wanted, everything you ever desired, just trust me, Angela, let go. And I did. I surrendered. I knew I had done such a bang up job with all that control. Here I was. I couldn't fix anything or anybody. It was so hopeless and such a mess. Everything that I just remember going, oh my gosh, God, you got it. You got it. And I sought God and recovery like a love affair, like I sought the drugs and the men. Let me tell you, I was all in. I just said, I can't. You can. I am powerless over all of this. My life is unmanageable. The steps. I went to Celebrate Recovery. I joined a step study, you know, and Celebrate Recovery was really good. I'd been to NA and AA for Always, and they're good too. For the first year and a half, all I did was go to meetings. Every day I was either in a meeting or church, but I just said, I can't do this. God, you're going to have to, because it was such a mess. I didn't know how anything, I didn't even know how I was going to drive. I mean, I had a DUI. I had no money. I had no nothing. Everybody was, I was like, I had to just seek God first and hard with all that I had, do the very next right thing that was within my power, and let the rest go and give the rest to God. Every day, every moment, I had to just 1 minute at a time hang on. I remember like, oh my gosh, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know how I'm going to face this. I got my son here. Yeah. And I just remember, you got it, God. You got it. Surrendering. And step two, came to believe. It takes a while, that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I didn't really know what sanity was. I'd never had sanity, but I believed he did. I knew he knew what sanity was, and I believed him and the millions that had gone before me. I was listening. I was open. I was all in. You know, I hung on to people that had what I wanted, you know. And then step three, to me, not the most important. Step one is, because if you don't admit you're totally powerless, you can never get to anywhere else. But step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life, not some of it, not 50% of it, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And that's what I did. I turned it all over. I can't, you can. And I hung on for dear life. That's what, 1 minute at a time. I was all in. That's how I did it. He did it. I joined a step study. I started working the steps. I stayed in meetings. I went to inner healing. I went to counseling. I hung on for dear life. I got in the word. You know, God did a lot for me in the word. You know, I slept with my Bible under my pillow every night. I mean, literally. I turned on the radio. I remember I had to get out of rock and roll. I loved rock and roll, but man, it had all these memories for me. So literally, I couldn't even listen to my music. I had to turn on Z88.3. And I remember in the beginning going, oh my gosh. but I got to put good in my head. You know what I'm saying? Because my head is such a sick place, right?
Yeah.
I was just like, I couldn't afford to think, or even those songs. Every song would take me somewhere not good. You know, as much as I love those rock and roll songs, they would all just take me to this euphoric place, this healthy place. And I couldn't afford to need to go to that euphoric place. So I started turning on Z88.3 and I would listen to those songs. And one day I just started, because I needed my head. I had to take captive every thought. I had to get out of my head, man. You know, the battlefield, the battle's in the head. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to think right. So I just put good stuff in my head and I hung with the winners and I hung around all these people that were like boring at first, but that's what I did. I hung around people that loved God and had what I wanted, you know, and I ended up loving that music and, you know, and I just, he changed me from the inside out. I just hung on to him, trusted him, leaned not on my own understanding because I didn't understand nothing. In all my ways, acknowledge him and he would direct my path. I just hung on to that. I remember just saying that all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time, because I believed him. I didn't have faith in anybody in this world. Every single person in this world had let me down. Hmm. Everyone. I mean, they'd betrayed me, really. I mean, I didn't trust people anymore. No one. But the cool thing, even me.
Especially you.
Especially me. And God, you know, but he was the one, God was the one I did trust. It was like, I had to. There was, for me, it had to be, there wasn't anybody left to trust. It had to be that way so that I could learn to trust God.
Yeah.
For once. And for all to run my life. And I'll tell you what, he did. And the cool thing is through working the steps and healing from the inside out and learning to love myself, the longer you don't pick up a drug, a drink, a man, or anything for relief or peace, or, you know, you just, oh, you got to feel your way through the feelings and just not pick up nothing or nobody for relief. The longer you do that, the more you start liking yourself. As you're working the steps and God's cleaning out all the garbage and the ick and the false belief systems and all the crap, and he's filling us back up with good, and we're learning to like ourselves because we're making good choices and doing the right thing.
Yes.
And once you learn to love that person and you know you've been redeemed and you're forgiven and you're, it's funny because then you're like, God sets you free to love others with like all this love inside of you, but you don't need anything back from them, even if they betray you, even if they don't, because you know you they can't hold you up. The world can't let you down because they don't hold you up anymore. You don't need their approval, you don't need their love back. You just love them because you're full of all this love of what God's done for you, and you just want to give it back. You just want to help others feel what you feel. I mean, for the first time in my life, I got peace. That's all I ever wanted, was peace and love and to feel loved. And I didn't need it from a person. I knew God loved me. It was like he forgave me, even me, a wretched, the worst sinner of all, like me, if he could forgive me. You know, it's like, I just wanted to spend the rest of my life showing anybody that they can be redeemed, you know? And it's funny because my life is not about me, the Trinity of me anymore. Me. You know, it's, I just want to, I have all this love in me that God filled me with that I want to give back and help others to know how much they're loved. The most broken of the broken. I love to go to the streets. That's why I have 2 recovery homes. I love these women. They think they're so hopeless. No, they're not. Come on, let's go. I know the way.
You know? So take us there in the last few minutes of the show. Take us to Armor Up. And so, because now we understand where Armor Up comes from. Now we understand why you do what you do. So what do you do now, and how are you there for other women? And if there's a woman out there that is feeling what you're saying right now, and she's still stuck in the crossfire and feeling like, well, that may be good for you, Angela, but you don't know my story and you don't know my pain. You don't know what I'm currently dealing with. And I don't know if I can get what you got. Speak to her.
You know, that's where God does his very best work. I had a counselor tell me one time, or inner healing, when I was in her, and I told her, I said, I feel like I'm just broken into a million little pieces. I'm just a million little pieces. This was at the beginning. And she goes, good. That's a good place to start. Now God can put you back together right. And I was like, it was an epiphany. It was, because I was broken at one little piece at a time. All I had to do was surrender. That's it. Surrender my will, surrender my ways. Trust God, get my butt to a meeting, you know, to celebrate. Get to a meeting, like the sober living houses. I love these places. You know, I had a little girl. I couldn't go to one of these. But yeah. I love what I do because when they come, they're just like a deer in headlights. Like, you know, I don't know what to do. They're just like, they're at the end of the end of the end of the end. If you've got the gifts of desperation and hopelessness, that's where God does his best work. If you still think you can fix it or you can control it or, you know, forget it. But if you've done all you can, you know, the hope is that you got to let go and let God. It's not just a cliche. So like our recovery house, Freedom House and Victory House. This is for women that are at the bottom of the bottom, but they don't want to just sobriety. This isn't just a halfway house and a flopway house. We want to help women that are struggling out there heal from the inside out, all the demons that have been tormenting them their whole life. Because if you take the drink and the drug and the man away from one of us without healing from the inside, oh my gosh, you got a raving lunatic, right? There's a better way. There's a better way through the 12 steps, through surrender, through these women. Oh my gosh, what God is doing there. We've had our first couple of them graduate. You know, they worked the steps. They go to Celebrate Recovery. They give back. They have a sponsor. We do Bible studies. We do family dinners where we all cook together and they shop together and they do life together. We cannot do this alone. I tried all those years to do it alone. We can't do it alone. We cannot do this alone. You know, the support system there, the accountability, we've got to have that accountability. Our best thinking got us right to where you are. If you're out there and you're at the bottom, your best thinking got you right there. You know, the millions that have gone before you and made it out of hell alive, because there's people with a lot worse story than mine. Street. I got women off the streets, man, that were prostituting, crack at. I mean, seriously. And you know what? All you got to do, surrender. Surrender. I'm done. Help. 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 Humble yourself. Come on. Let's go. Link yourself with these women. We got women that come in from the outside, from the groups I attend and that I lead that are part of the tribe, you know, with these women. We got a whole tribe of women there to help each other. And the families. It's a family. We help support the family. We get them into counseling. We help with DCF. I write letters to DCF. I've had drug courts in my houses. I mean, we'll help them in every avenue. We believe in the power of love, redemption, and transformation for any woman. We can help them change their story and equip them. And no matter what they've been through, the more broken, the better. That's where God does his best work.
Thank you. Thank you. And how can they reach you?
How can they reach you? ArmorUp.com. ArmorUp40.
No. Yeah. ArmorUp40, the number 40.com.
Number40.com is our website. We've got, you could look at everything that we have there. We have a bunch of photos. We just did our blog, everything we're doing. We could sure use financial assistance too and partnership. I want to take these women on a missions trip. We give back. We go feed the homeless. We made 91 backpacks because I want these women to do what I do. They're going to go and be the change. So armorup40.com. We're on Facebook under Armor Up Recovery Homes and Ministry and Instagram, Twitter. They can go look us up there. My name, my number, everything is on the website or Facebook.
Thank you, Angela. Thank you very much. I mean, what a special story. And thank you for sharing so much reality with us. I mean, I'm sure there's a ton of women that can absolutely relate because I'm a man and I can relate. So if as a man, I can relate to your story, I can only imagine how you're telling so many women's story right now. And I know by the Facebook Live feed that a lot of people are supporting you and that know you and are sending all kinds of messages right there on Facebook Live. So thank you. Thank you for being here today. And thank you for sharing with us. Trinity, so where's your head at?
Quite silent. How awesome was that, dude? It's like, for real. Seriously. I was just in awe, man. Thank you so much for sharing. I think what I love most about it is it kind of coincides with where him and I come from all the time. And we just did a 24-hour version of it. And that's hope. You know, it gives hope. And that's what I love most about it. That's what I took from it. Is because everybody does have a moment in their lives, be it addiction or not. They all have a moment where this, like, this, for lack of a better term, this self-pity of, like, it's just hopeless. It's never going to get any better. And it's all bullshit, right? It can get better. It's all about the mindset and just taking those steps and moving forward and believing in it. So thank you for doing what you do, man. You were an awesome woman. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you all very much. We appreciate you, Angela, all the people from Armor Up. Good luck to all the women that have gone through your program, that are in the program, that are going to go to the program. And to anybody out there still suffering, just know that you can reach out. You can get help. You can call us at 833-NOW-MATTERS. And we can connect you with Angela. We can connect you with other programs like Angela's if you're not in this area. Obviously, we're in Central Florida. Angela's in Central Florida. Armor Up's in Central Florida. But it doesn't mean that you can't get help where you're at. You just have to reach out, and we have to work together to find someone just like this in that community, in your community. There's always somebody just like us in every community. It's just, you know, sometimes it's just hard to navigate and find them. So again, it's 833-NOW-MATTERS if you want that help. So from all of us here on the couch live, again, thank you very much, Angela, all the good folks at Armor Up, all the good people that were listening and watching on Facebook Live. Thanks to you, my partner, the Dharma Guy, Trinity Phillips. If you want to follow us, there's our names. There's how you do it. At the Dope Doctor, at the Dharma Guy. And adios, amigos. It's time for a taco. Goodbye.